said I was going to be rooting against history yesterday, and Ovi scored 2 goals. Got 3 against the Leafs this season. Hurts. It hurts. Leafs grab a nice win, though. Raptors, oof. I actually have some thoughts later on in the show today. And outside of Leafs talk, I did spend most of my night, like many of you, refreshing Shohei Ohtani memes. And I think this market especially can appreciate those. But I just want to say this quickly. I got Dave Damashek today. I got Mike Bibby today. Great guests. Great job by Armin. Much better than DeRozan night from him. Much better performance this week after DeRozan night we got last week. Leafs grab a nice win. I mentioned on Leafs Talk last night, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this because Sammy and I went really long. We did 40 minutes. So Leafs Talk is sitting right there for you. Subscribe and review to this. But I had 2 thoughts that have kind of stuck with me throughout the night. One was, I hate admitting this, and I'll probably talk about it with him next week, but maybe James Myrtle was right that the Leafs should have been a bit more aggressive when it comes to addressing the center position. I still remain that there wasn't really anybody or anything that really intrigued me. I still don't really like the price, even when people bring up Adam Henrique. But yeah, if you were going to sell your first round pick and you were going to be the quote unquote all in for this year, I don't know if that's really what that would have looked like. All in, throwing that first in, being precious with the first, I think is the way that Myrtle put it. If they would have been able to turn that into a Wenberg or a Henrique type, I think you would have looked at this roster and said, there is a better way to balance it. And in a weird way, the flirtation with Domi down the middle and that line that was really fun for a lot of people, it may have been a situation where both sides were right. That a lot of people in the Domi camp were looking at it and going, man, this guy can play up with the top 6. You got to give this guy an opportunity to actually play with players. And isn't this the team's formula? It's not just going to be Nylander, Matthews, and Marner this year. You need the other 2 guys that were on that line, Bertuzzi and Domi, to become contributors. And they were. They were starting to turn up. They were starting to contribute a little bit more. You were seeing more from Max Domi. You were seeing more from Tyler Bertuzzi. And you felt a little bit more confident as a Leaf fan because there was scoring distribution. And that remains to be true with me right now. That's the way I feel about this team is, okay, you got 2 goaltenders that I think are playing well. I think that you should feel moderately confident in the goaltending, okay? Like, debate aside, whoever's in there, you should feel decent about. The blue line is, it's not going to get fixed, and I don't think there was a way to fix it. They have TJ Brody that gets scratched last night, and we're going to see where that conversation goes. I would assume it's just going to end up being one night off and then the Leafs move forward. It's not going to have a major ripple effect, but I just don't think that there was a way of fixing it. But with the forwards right now, you feel like McMahon, Domi, Bertuzzi, and Knies specifically could all score you a really big goal in the playoffs and provide sustainable scoring throughout the playoffs. Not just get the one, not just get a fluky one, but all 4 of those guys are going to be dangerous. And that's more than the Leafs have had in a really long time. That's a lot better than what they had last year, even when they were sitting there with a loaded deadline, one where they did go all in. The difference is, though, is that they did have Ryan O'Reilly, and that allowed them to split up the offenses. And, you know, Paul Maurice told Kipper and Bourne it was really tough to match up with those guys. And granted, it was they beat him in 5 games, but at least did outplay him in a bunch of those games for what it's worth. But it was harder to match up with them when they did have the 3 centermen. And that's sort of how I feel about the Leafs right now is you've got an abundance of wingers. You've got all these guys that can actually contribute for you. Finally. But when you're healthy and you bring back Yarncroc and you bring back Marner, by the way, I should have mentioned Yarncroc in that group of guys that could feel like they provide you with offense. So it's like, that's 5 guys, 5, but all 5 of those guys are wingers and 2 of your biggest stars are wingers. So there's just a little, it's great. It's amazing to have secondary scoring. This is a good problem to have. Absolutely. At the end of the day, you just do wish that there was a pivot that was a little bit better than the 2 guys that you have right now that are depth dudes with Kampf and Duehr. And it did also make me think, like, maybe one of the things that's going to have to happen during the offseason, not to get way too ahead of ourselves, but is getting rid of David Kampf's contract. And that maybe that one actually ended being sort of one of the worst mistakes of this front office's offseason? Because in signing Kampf to that deal, the implication was, okay, well, this guy's going to be your matchup center. But he can't really score. He does stay healthy. And he does do just enough for you to go, well, we got to play him. It was difficult to only give him the 8 minutes a night flanked by Ryan Reeves at the beginning of the season, right? Nobody was really enjoying that. But then if you bump him up to a 3C, there's not enough offense to really have him sit there. He's kind of like a tweener center. He's basically what we call a 4A prospect in baseball, but for centermen, where too good to be your fourth line center at that price, especially, but clearly not good enough to be your 3C. And so he's just kind of clogging up the joint. And I like David Kampf. Like, I don't think that he's a bad player. I think he's fine. And I defended the contract when it first happened, but I think for this team and the fits that they need and potentially what they're going to end up needing moving forward, he might have been a little bit of a mistake. Anyways, the moral of the story is you feel really good about a whole bunch of guys that can actually score for this team right now. The guy who left them in this situation, though, Kyle Dubas. I know we talk about him a lot, but it's an interesting time for Pittsburgh sports. They just got a couple of new quarterbacks, both of which everybody, I would think both of which are pretty close to household names. And yeah, they've got the end of Sidney Crosby's career, and it's in the hands of a guy that Toronto sports fans are very familiar with. Anyways, who better to talk about it with Dave Damaschek? Here's my interview with him. Thanks for doing this, buddy.
Sure thing. I apologize. I just, as I was just saying, I'm a pain in the ass, and
you're the worst. I agree.
Credit for chasing.
No, you're the worst. You're the worst. I agree. That's just it's true. You nailed it. You nailed it. All right. We'll just start this thing. We'll get going. It's Dave Damaschek, the -3 podcast. Okay. So I normally send my guests some topics and go, here's what the prep is, but I actually think this is all right up your alley. Like, if you can't answer some of these, it's a real disservice to you. Like, you're kind of going to get exposed as a fraud if you don't have answers for some of these questions today. You ready?
Have I not proven to consistently be a letdown? Yes. As I always say, you know, as the Cleveland Browns, New York Jets, and Dave Damaschek prove, and I guess I could throw the Toronto Maple Leafs into that mix too.
Dude,
are we sure consistency is always the thing to strive for?
Yeah, that's true. You know what? That's a really great point. I think that, you know, that's great too, because now all my producers, when they're bad at their jobs, are going to use that line. Hey, well, like Dave said, it's not great to be consistent. At least we're not consistently awful. We're just awful some of the time. That's going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to it. Okay, so I actually want to start with this because I was thinking about you in this interview, and I had some Pittsburgh questions for you, right? And, you know, I've had Pittsburgh on the brain a lot lately with what happened at the NHL trade deadline and then what's happened subsequently with the Steelers and their quarterback situation. But it kind of dawned on me in a lot of our chats and – a lot of my conversations with Steelers fans in general and Pittsburgh sports fans in general is that you guys have a weird thing that a lot of sports fans don't have, from my viewpoint anyways, which is underlying optimism for things. And maybe it's because the Steelers have had success, and maybe it's because the Penguins had success. But whenever I talk to my Steelers fans buddies, right, whenever I try to rib them, they're always like, oh, man, Kenny Pickett's going to be the man. He's going to be incredible. I remember talking to you about in the Ben Roethlisberger season where everyone's like, they're frauds. You're like, I believe they're going to be good. They're going to be fine. Penguins fans, you know, Carlson, everyone in the world was going, this isn't going to be great. And Penguins fans are like, no, we're buying in. We're doing this. Is this just my bubble? Or do you actually think that maybe you guys, at least at the outset of things, go into it more open-minded and positive because you've actually seen results in multiple sports?
Huh. It's funny that you would say that. And obviously you're bouncing off anecdotally with people who are rooting for black and gold teams.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you you're wrong. My ongoing sense, or at least has been for the last couple few years, is that there is a transition into being much more Philadelphia, Boston, New York-y, which is, you know, more acidic. In fact, I've always made fun of the fact that, you know, Philadelphia as a sports town seems to have this weird misplaced pride in its local media and fan base that they will boo guys from their teams, and to the point that that those guys crumble and leave, and they'll say, hey, Philly ain't for everybody. Philly's a tough sports town. Are you sure you're helping out your teams if you're running some percentage of guys out of town because no one might want to be there? It's a little bit weird. I don't know that it's something to aspire to be. It's funny because, of course, where a conversation starts with a Pittsburgh sports fan is, as I said, you know, now 20 years, and it's been 20 years ago, and I've noticed if you go around parts of Pittsburgh, you'll find it in tchotchke shops, mugs and such that have it. I did a you know, one of those city limits signs that said, welcome to Pittsburgh, city of champions and the Pirates. And so that's the sort of opening.
You do have the Pirates.
You have a, it's like, well, hey, we have the Steelers, and look at what the Penguins have done over the last 30, 40 years. But the Bucks are terrible, and they're purposely bad. And so, of course, we have a bit of cynicism delivered there, and it's been, you know, entrenched now over the last half
century. Almost apathy, though, right? Like, that's like I just know the way that I view the Pirates from the outside is this is my Pirates memories. You had one wild card game you got into. You guys had Andrew McCutchen for a while, who everybody liked. End of list.
Yeah, that's more or less right. It's funny. It feels like such a blip. It feels so random. The fact is, they played in three straight of those one game wild card playing games.
Oh my God, I would have got that so wrong. If you would have done the over under, like over under 1.5, I would have been like, this is the easiest answer of all time. Under, and I would have gotten it wrong by 2. Oof, that's tough. That's really tough. That's apathy at its finest.
Yeah, and but I mean, you would really have to be a pie-eyed optimist to be feeling good about anything in Pittsburgh right now, because you mentioned, well, as a matter of fact, I guess I am the pessimist in that Steelers quarterback situation. It feels like the majority of people who root for the Steelers and people who don't care about the Steelers feel like that what they just did over the last week and a half was good stuff. I'm more skeptical of all that, but along with the Penguins, and by the way, just from the I wonder, you know, you're up there in you know, the center of the hockey world, and I wonder, does everybody the world over feel the level of like it? This is I don't want to get into hyperbole. The Pittsburgh Penguins power play of this year is one of the great mysteries of my lifetime as a sports fan. Like, you know, I used to always say and kind of laugh about, like, how could you have two of the five best players in baseball in Ohtani and Trout and never get anywhere close to the playoffs? Same goes for Draisaitl and McJesus. That two of the five best, and they've never been to a final. Maybe this is the year that they'll finally shake that off. But I legitimately now think this trumps that. How could you have one of the four or five best players in the history of people? You have one of the, in Geno Malkin, as he fades away, nevertheless, still one of the 40 or 50 great forwards that we've seen, Jake Guentzel while he was still there, one of the generation's great goal scorers, and then Letang and Carlson. I mean, how could that be? It's not that it has underwhelmed. It's not that it was like, we thought this was going to be our advantage all season long. We're going to game the system, and we're going to make our hay by winning a man up, and that will offset the deficiencies we have top to bottom against the real heavyweight teams. It's not that they've been league average, and if they were league average, they would be in a playoff spot now. They're down there with the San Jose Sharks. What the hell? It is a mystery. I don't get it.
Yeah. So one of my good buddies, Colby Armstrong, covers the team for you guys, and you know, I love texting with Colby. He's as optimistic as they come, and he's a sharp guy. He knows the game well. He watches every single Penguins game. He's never been able to put his finger on it. I can't either. It seems like the easy thing to do is to say it's just a too many cooks in the kitchen situation, but that's never been a problem with a power play before. It's not like Edmonton deals with that. They're like, well, we got McDavid and Draisaitl. It's too many good guys. It's like, yeah, no. Everybody else has good guys on their power play. I'm at a complete loss for it too, but the weirdest part is that when you watch you guys, it doesn't, you know, the numbers haven't been there, but it doesn't feel threatening either. Like, there's almost like a sapping of energy at times watching the Penguins and the top power play unit get run out there this season. It's frankly sad. Like, it's really sad, because this is the reason why I have so many Pittsburgh fans in my orbit, is that my age group, Steelers fans, there's always been a ton of them in Southern Ontario. Like, it's basically the demographic goes Bills, Steelers, and Browns. Those are the primary three teams, like by a wide margin. And then Pittsburgh, though, has always been sort of Canada's team. It's one of the, you're the one with the take about you were kind of happy that Sid scored the golden goal, right? That's yours?
No. Because you must be thinking of somebody else, because I wasn't kind of happy. I was over the moon about it.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Okay, that's it. Yes.
It was one of the great things I'd seen in 1987 before you walked the planet Earth in all likelihood, Bunkus.
Yes.
I celebrated when 66 Mario Lemieux finished off the Russians in Canada Cup.
Yes.
Yes, I was equally excited. Now, this was more controversial because, of course,
No, it's an insane take. It's an insane take, especially from an American.
I completely disagree. Why? Why is that insane? Black and gold over red, white, and blue. That's all.
Well, that's okay. You know what? When you put it that way, it actually does fit more of an American, where you're like, states' rights, baby. You know, like our state is everything, more so than it is about the actual nation. But I just, okay, so we had this big hullabaloo up here. I don't know if, did you see the Joey Votto letter? We're all over the place, but did you see the letter? He apologized to Canadians last week.
I did see and, that. Yes, I did.
Yeah, he apologized to us because he said he didn't care about Canada baseball, and that hurt our feelings immensely. Like, enough that this happened 7 years ago. And I actually said on my show the other day that if this happened in the States, right, if like someone came out, right, if Garrett Cole went and said, I don't care at all about USA baseball, I don't care about America, he would have never lived it down. And yet here you are being like, yeah, golden goal, Sidney Crosby, that going in the net, it's rooting for it. To invert it. And again, I didn't have any state. If Austin Matthews scored a goal for USA hockey in Canada in the Olympics coming back, and it was the game-winning goal for a gold medal, I genuinely do not think I could do my job properly anymore. Like, it would ruin me and my relationship with Austin Matthews. I think it would cause irreparable harm. I would hate his guts for the rest of his career. I would never get over it.
I guess what we're talking about here is priorities, you know?
Yes.
I guess I could tie it. It kind of makes sense to bring it give it some currency. This thing that I'm getting from a lot of Steelers fans this last week and a half is like, dude, you're such a Kenny Pickett lover. You don't even know that this sucks, dude. Just because you're up in his jock and all that, because Kenny Pickett went to Pitt and you like Pitt, like you don't care about, like, I mean, you're really tying yourself into knots, ain't you? Like. I like Pitt and at the expense of my rooting for the Steelers. Like, what are you talking about? No, I just thought spiritually. In fact, I think I'm a little Pollyanna or whatever about this, or maybe I'm being a little precious. That to me, I think that there are rare opportunities, and not every team, not every city cares about some things. You know, the transient towns like LA and Vegas probably don't care if Vegas had a native who could be the Raiders quarterback. I don't know that people in Nevada care about that. Maybe they do, and I would be disproved. But in a place like provincial Pittsburgh, the opportunities that people are now applying 2020 hindsight to, and even at the time before the draft, I said the one concern, if Kenny Pickett happened to be there for the Steelers, would be some weird assumption about what he's going to do, or a make good on what Dan Marino not landing in Pittsburgh 40 years ago is somehow that this is the big reckoning for that in the space time continuum. And there was an added pressure to being the Pitt kid and all that, and people knowing who he was.
Of course.
But people have now said, like, who cares? He's no good. He got to go, dude. Like, and they shouldn't have drafted him in the first place. I will 100 for 100 times, when something rare like that is available to you, you definitely have to take the shot. If it doesn't work out,
I agree.
You shrug it off and you move on. But of course, these are the things that you live. Now, I get it for you. This is weird. But also, in terms of priorities, like I say, Pitt versus Steelers and all that. Come on. I mean, like, Canada has to rise to the top for you in hockey, right?
Has
I don't want to be an ugly American, but that has
no,
to
no,
be
you're not, you're not, you're not. No, you're right, you're right. No, no, it's you're not being an ugly American at all. It's a fact. I actually was when I so you know the country is not. We're not in the best place right now. Like, we've got our own divisive election coming up. It's very much the undercard to yours. Like, okay.
No, you guys have yours. We're doing beautifully. So it's a shame to hear that things aren't going as well up there.
Yeah. Okay. So But there's some, I was talking, I like to joke with my friends and, you know, talk about Canadian identity a lot, right? Like what we have, what it means to be Canadian. And because, you know, we were raised with certain things and now it's a kind of a moving target that we don't have. And one of the things that I do love to mention is like, we don't even have Olympic hockey anymore. Like it's gone. It's ever since we had 2010, it was this incredibly important moment for our country. People actually said it was a defining moment of our country. And then they took Olympics away and it was like, oh, what do we do now? Where do we go with this? All this energy that we have, it's incredibly important to us. So no, I,
lacrosse? For me, can we get that in there? Can we get the lacrosse going, everybody? Is the US in that now too? I wonder, maybe.
Definitely. Yes. This is the worst part is that it's technically our national sport, but I've been to one lacrosse game in my entire life. And it was because I said I could be a professional lacrosse goalie on the show. And then the professional lacrosse team challenged me to come out. And yeah, they're better than me, I guess. They've had a whole life of training. But it was a fun experience.
It's funny. It is funny that when you say something, sometimes you forget that it's conceivable that people other side might pick it up. That, if it's being recorded into a microphone or whatever.
It bends my brain.
On more than one occasion. In L.A. too. Maybe that was the miscalculation. But I've said that maybe Southern California doesn't need two NHL teams, and maybe the Anaheim Ducks, who I've never had a conversation in 25 years of living in Southern California. No one has ever come up to me and been like, how about them Ducks, right?
Yeah, they're doing great. Okay, got to get down to the Honda Center tonight. It's a real buzz. No.
Well, the thing is with them is they have 20,000 fans. They all go to the games, and those are the 20,000 people. So unless you cross their paths directly, I always advocate – move them up to Portland. Now we're talking about rivalries. But I'll also offend people in Canada by saying that I wish that the NFL would partner with the CFL and just turn it into our minor league.
Yeah, that's offensive.
That would be better.
That hurts our feelings. That does hurt our feelings because we try to keep that thing as our own, even though, truthfully, I go to games here in Toronto, but it's a sparse crowd and it's hard to get people's attention. And there's something about Toronto, which is we're a high event city and we don't have time for anything other than the best of the best. And so you can't run a secondary football league here. Nobody cares. We only care about the NFL. We constantly want the NFL to move here, and that's all we ever want. My Ducks take was I begged them not to get Connor Bedard because I didn't want to lose Connor Bedard to, you know, that, the 20,000 only ever seeing him play a night. And I actually took flack from fake Duck fans, or I guess there's the 20,000 are very much on social media because they found
that clip. They're real, and they have a chip on their shoulder because they're rare. Yeah. It's like following a band that's not on a major label yet. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. It's that vibe.
Yeah, they showed up for that. Okay, so I'm going to close the loop on a couple of things here before I dig a little bit deeper into Pens and the Steelers quarterback thing. One is, I'm actually glad to kind of hear that the Pittsburgh positivity is starting to fade just a little bit. The optimism thing is because Steelers' last Super Bowl is 2009 and Penguins is 2017. Is that one like 2016?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, you guys had a good grace period and you've been good fans and you get the teams and everything's been fine. But now you're starting to transition into that era where the Steelers have been 500 for too many years and the Tomlin record thing has not become a point of pride anymore. It's now becoming we get it. We're mediocre. And the Penguin stuff is Sid is so good that it feels like you're starting to like the rest of the world is actually rooting for you guys to lose him so that we can see him go play somewhere competitive. So I like that. I like that you're joining the rest of us. And I get what you're saying about the Philly fans and how they are proud to throw batteries, but I got to admit, I actually kind of respect that more now because I feel like we're entering this era of when people have sports takes or critical, JJ Redick comes out of the sky and it's like, what you people don't understand is that the athlete has it the hardest. And then I get my back up and I'm like, nah, I want to embrace my inner Philly fan. You know what I mean? So I think it's a fine line of finding both, but welcome Pittsburgh to normal sports fandom, which is
I do agree with you. To devil's damn check what I said. Yes, I don't think you need as a local media to spook to spook away the emotionally brittle players who might make a difference for you. On the other hand, speaking of emotionally brittle, this is a weird new phase that we've entered, which is you guys are being mean to me and I don't like it. Like, all right. Listen, Daniel Day-Lewis, if you don't want to, I have always resented that. Like Daniel, he's a thespian. Like, you know, he wants to make the film. He's in it for the craft. Like, Okay, well then don't make major movies, man. Let's not pretend you didn't know this was part of the gig that you had to do interviews about your movie.
I've actually been saying.
I'm sorry that you're getting criticism when your team loses. That's part of why you're getting the millions of dollars.
No, it's insane. It drives me crazy, and it's like, and not only that, now these guys make so much money, like immediately, like dudes are making money coming out of college, and you're like, yeah, that's not everything, but the lifestyle you have is far greater. The business that has been built on the backs of people for this entertainment product, I hate it. I hate the hoity-toity. Why don't we just care about the games, and why can't we just let these guys go and playoffs are a coin flip and people care too much? That stuff breaks me. Okay, so
yeah, why can't we just appreciate greatness? We don't have to debate. Like, I mean, should the sports media just go away then? Like, I mean, what do you want us to do with ourselves? Of course, this is what's fun about being a sports fan is categorizing and quantifying and all that kind of stuff is the pleasure of doing. And it doesn't have to be based around analytics either and produced by computers. It can be produced by our gut and our heart and our memories. Yes. And that's what we feed off of as fans. And the diminishment about that, I really could ascend up to Mount Pius about all the stuff about the basically what they're saying is in one way or another, whether it's analytics people or athletes or otherwise, is grow up, everybody. Grow up. If we grow up, then sports spectatorship goes away. So you better hope we don't grow up, everybody.
Yeah, completely agree. I feel that way every year with All-Star Game is whenever you go, I think they could make it better. The immediate response from everyone is, what are you, a baby? You want the All-Star Game to be better? It's for kids. And I go, who brings the kids to the games? You're supposed to, who's bringing them? They're not just walk-ups. It's not six-year-olds out on the sidewalk being like, the All-Star Game's in town. We got to go to this. Grab all your friends from the second grade. It's supposed to be, in my opinion, like a Pixar movie where you take your kid and you go to it, but you're going to be you're going to have a fine time as well. You're going to go, oh, you know what? That wasn't horrible for me, which All-Star Games have become. And all of sports kind of is. I hate that, the boiling down of it of, yes, this is for children. You're like, yeah, no, I don't agree.
Well, and it really does tie back to, like I say, with my defense, which people are basically saying, like, grow up. The Pitt team that you grew up with, who gives a crap about all that? Well, if I can't tie myself to that and sort of go back to, I can't say to my kids that this guy, if you can't express those roots, obviously I root for French Canadian guys and Russian guys and Puerto Rican guys and guys from all over the globe who wear the black and gold of the teams I root for. But in those rare instances where there is a native guy who can walk in there to root for, it makes it a little bit more special, obviously.
It's the best. It's the best. It's absolutely the best. Like, there's
I don't care who he is. I just want to win games. Like, all right, then maybe, maybe flipping coins is more for you, or video games. I don't know what to tell you, man.
I actually just pictured a guy. He's like, what do you do? He's like, I flip coins. You're like, elaborate on this. He's like, I sit around, I flip them, I mark it down, and then I keep a little journal, I keep a little log, and then I go to sleep every night satisfied with that. Okay, I'm going to come back to Dubas then. I'm going to go to the Steelers thing and the quarterback stuff. Okay, I did feel that Kenny Pickett connection from your fan base, that he was supposed to be like the chosen one, the guy to shepherd the new era of Steelers fandom. And, you know, he had – there was no greater way to illustrate, I think, how deeply you guys felt for him than all of his numbers being atrocious, like him never throwing touchdown passes and all of you going – well, it's not the opportunity. Like, you guys would make a million excuses for the guy. The rest of us would watch him and go, what's going on here? Why is this guy a thing at all? He'd get Mason Rudolph step in and look more competent at the position. And we would go, yeah, see, don't you get it? So I get moving past him, and I understand, you know, feeling the way that you do about him going to a different spot or taking that shot. But out of the two new guys, here's my sense. That no one liked the Russell Wilson signing, even though it was $1 million because he's Russell Wilson. But everyone is going to be rooting for the Fields thing to pan out, even though Wilson has been, I think, all but guaranteed the starting job.
A recurring theme of this conversation is that your read on things, and you're not wrong. I'm fascinated by how you see things with an objective eye versus what I'm picking up from, you know, visceral sort of angst about, is this the right thing to do? And do they need to move on from those quarterbacks and bring these guys in and all that kind of stuff. I feel like the initial reaction to Russ was people getting real excited about it. And I don't want to, you know,
really?
Be a snob or condescend or whatever, but I think a lot of people, you know, they, you know, name brands are meaningful. And so I assume if you're semi-casual about watching football beyond your favorite team, which is something that happens a lot, is that, you know, that's definitely true with me and the NHL. I mean, when I talk about watching the NHL, you know, 80% of it is Penguins games. You know, I'm not watching a ton of Campbell Conference showdowns. And I mean, more and more I have over the last 10 years.
No,
the game's
all sports are becoming far and far more regional. It's where the viewing experience is far too competitive for us to watch teams that we're not interested in. We have too much to watch. We get it. You're
right,
excused.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, and also having kids and all that kind of stuff that happens. Yeah. But I suppose previous generations also were having kids too.
Yeah,
I don't know. We'll have to. I'll investigate the science on that. I don't know how they got to the
kids before the kids.
How they got here.
Yeah.
Where they came from. Right. Yeah. And who's taking them to All-Star games. Got to figure it all out.
Exactly. Yeah, that is it.
But I think a lot of people hear Russell Wilson and don't know much about what went down in Denver. And, you know, they remember him in the Super Bowls a decade ago. And, you know, if you dig up his raw stats, you know, 30-year-old Russ would be a massive upgrade. 35, 36-year-old Russ is not the player he once was. He's not as dynamic. He's not the threat he was as a functional scrambler. He's never thrown over the middle. That's a problem in Arthur Smith's offense. So a lot of the claims like, oh, he's a perfect fit. Don't you see that that's what he's going to do? Play action, under center, all that. That's valid. Bottom line is he just has not been good for the last 3 or 4 years. And I think that there's this residual sort of like he's dangerous, the Super Bowl hero and all of that that feeds that. And then I think the enthusiasm for Justin Fields to double down on the skepticism of what they've just done here. I like the upside, obviously, like everybody else. He's a specimen and what he potentially could do. Obviously, he's, 10-28 as a starter in an atrocious situation. I allow for better circumstance to allow for the individual to improve. And that was a terrible spot he was in Chicago. You know, it doesn't change the fact that he also holds onto the ball for too long. He turns the ball over quite a bit. I think that there's something to a Pittsburgh fan thinking that they watched a quarterback who succeeded in Roethlisberger playing off script. He's not Tom Brady or Drew Brees on time. It's more, you know, breaks down, hero plays, you know, shaking off tacklers and all that. The problem is the virtue of Roethlisberger was that while he was doing all that, he was not a turnover machine, whereas Russell Wilson and Justin Fields both fumble the ball a ton. You hear a lot about this. But he was 26-8 in Denver last year. 15 games, he threw 8 interceptions. He also lost 8 fumbles. So let's be accurate here. He turned the ball over more than once a game last year, and before that he was a mess with Nathaniel Hackett, and before that the second half with Seattle didn't go well. So how many excuses are we going to make for the same guy in 3 different coaching environments? Now he's going to be improved? Maybe. That said, if he comes out and wins some games, Mike Tomlin is not likely to yank him, sort of Jim Harbaugh pulling Alex Smith in favor of Colin Kaepernick midseason just to see if they could get a little bit better. I don't see that probably happening. I think he'd stick with a winning premise. So if Russ comes out and wins games, just like Kenny Pickett was doing a year or the last year and a half, I guess, which is 12-11. I am maybe because I do feel a sense of being satiated, not spoiled, but to me, the reason I advocated the switch to the Crosby, Malkin, Letang situation, a lot of people in Pittsburgh and out said they should move on. They should reboot, let those guys go besides Crosby and start from scratch. I advocated to keep them. But, you know, everything, if the goal is, if you're going to be disappointed every year that your team doesn't win the title, if that's the only thing that has to happen or else it's been a lost season, you're going to be sad a lot of the time. I just so happened to have seen five Stanley Cups over the last 30
years. Yeah, I was going to say, this is the take of a guy who has seen winning, like, because the rest
that's
of
right.
us on
so
the
I don't,
outside
I, are, it's not yeah. like I have to see them win more. I have yeah. to, I, what I yeah. want is yeah. for Crosby to burnish his legacy and, get the point totals and otherwise yes. way up there. Now, also, it's embarrassing for them to miss the playoffs, so it's gone too far in that regard. But, I think that I think that the thing that has delighted me that has not been received as well in Pittsburgh by Steelers fans is I think it's hysterical that the Steelers can play the best teams in the league and the worst teams in the league, and you can count on the final score being 12-11 every week. It's yeah. I mean, it's like that's what they do. They grind you out no matter how good or bad you are. It always – and the thing people don't kind of accept is, like, yeah, they're dragging every team into the mud. Well, they're going to get dirty too. They're not going to put up – they're not going to be a 30-point-a-game team playing in that manner, and now there has been a philosophical adjustment that that's not good enough. We have to try to play with the big boys. And I do think that there is something to the idea that, as I keep saying, it's a funny sort of – I mean, almost as severe, but not mandated in any by any rules. But, you know, the American League forever had the DH and the NL had the pitchers hit. In the AFC now, it's all about if you have a superhero quarterback. And on the NFC side, it's about something else. I mean, Matt Stafford's the best quarterback over there. And, it's a lot of, line of scrimmage dominance wins the day. San Francisco, Philly the year before. And in the AFC, everybody is trying to keep up with the Joneses or the Mahomeses. And it's funny that the Bills have Allen and the Ravens have Lamar and, Trevor Lawrence down in Jacksonville and so on. But only Joe Burrow has been able to vanquish Thanos in Kansas City. Otherwise, everybody's like, you have no shot if you don't got one of those QBs. Like, well, as it turns out, all the teams that do have those QBs still can't get by Mahomes anyway. So, long story short, too late for that. But I do think that there is something to with a cheap quarterback room, which is what they had last year, too, with a rookie QB, is that they can really flesh out the roster specifically at the line of scrimmage and try to bully those teams in the AFC and overcome them that way. I think that's as good a chance. They have as good a chance of doing that as, say, the Bills do going forward or the Ravens.
Okay, so we kind of agree.
Even though I don't love either quarterback, I love everything
how could you?
Around.
No, you can't. Okay. The quarterbacks themselves. First of all, I don't know if you know this about me. I'm a Seahawks fan. I'm still bitter about the Super Bowl you took from us. It's the only time that an official has admitted to blowing calls and saying that he couldn't sleep at night because it was atrocious. It was truly the worst officiated Super Bowl of all time, but who cares? I hold no ill will against you. What I'm saying here is I know Russell Wilson. And I watched his game deteriorate. And the thing that made him special was the ability outside the pocket and then to extend plays but escape, and it's gone. He doesn't have it anymore. Now he's just a short little jacked guy with no juice who can still throw a deep ball. He's going to hit one. Dave, you are going to watch some deep balls to Pickens that you are going to have the greatest time watching. You're going to love it. He's going
to
drop one.
Before the Patriots Super Bowl, I spoke with Russell Wilson, and I asked him if he agrees that he throws the sexiest deep ball in the sport. He did.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said he did. I confirmed it with him. So there you go.
It is breathtaking. The problem is that he's not going to create those opportunities enough, and he's going to do those things that you just said. And then he's going to balance that. This is the thing you really have to prepare yourself for as a Steelers fan that I'm not sure you've actually ever had to do, because you've genuinely had a lot of cool teams and a lot of cool players. When Russell Wilson's your quarterback and he's starting, and I hope he tones it down a little, because I don't think he's going to do the whole, like, let's ride thing again. But when he's the face of your franchise, because all quarterbacks are, it doesn't matter if you have TJ Watt, you're going to have Russell Wilson. If he's successful, it's going to come with a burden in which you are going to have to, like, defend him to others and love him despite every moment that he steps in front of a camera, it almost causing you to cringe to death. It's painful. It's a strange burden. It is. It's a strange burden. And then with Fields, I just go, no one has benefited more from the like YouTube, Instagram era than Justin Fields, because it's always like, wow, look at this incredible play he made, this unbelievable run or this unbelievable throw. And then you look at the score and it's like Bears lost 38-16 and Fields had two picks and he didn't complete a pass for two quarters. And you're like, oh, okay. So that's what he was up to. Like when you have to watch a full Justin Fields game that isn't him in college, I think it's going to dawn on you why he went for a sixth round pick. And it's not just going to be about the contract, which I think some people have spun it into. But I do think this, I think that you've got two scenarios here. If your team is actually winning this year, if they actually have a chance to win a Super Bowl this year, it's because Russell Wilson got rid of the football quicker and didn't turn it over as much. And you got that scenario that you outlined. If your thought is that this team is for the future, then you just kind of have to hope that Fields wins this job and that this year is kind of a development season where he shows you enough to buy into the idea that he's going to be the guy to win you some football games over the next 3 years.
It's so funny you say that, because that's exactly what I have written down, because I'm going to go and record my show when we're done on Extra Points and Minus Three tomorrow. And that is my recurring thought now, as the debate has turned from Russ and, oh, they got Justin Fields and the Kenny Pickett melodrama and all of that. Yeah. And now it has been like, who's going to win that gig? Who should start? It's clearly going to be Fields. And so, right, I do think that is a fascinating thing for these next several months, is Steelers, fans, the locker room, and otherwise, like, you want Russ to play well. And so the best story would be, you can almost certainly guess, based on the fact that they rolled with Trubisky over Pickett, and that's not the exact same situation. Obviously, one's not a rookie in Fields, but new offense and all that. You can assume that Russ gets the week one start. Well, now what are you rooting for? You know Russ has a lower ceiling, but you want the Steelers to win. You want Russ to be the starter, because that means the Steelers are winning games. So, yeah, I think it's a funny spot there. You know, I mean, there's no evidence beyond Elway, Brady, Peyton Manning of any human being winning a Super Bowl at age 36. So I think people are building that up a little bit, but also the, you know, half the starts from Super Bowls among quarterbacks in the 21st century are guys on their rookie deal. Well, neither guy's going to really be that very soon. So those are things that kind of spook me a little bit. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. And as far as Russ, I know everybody loves to talk about cheesy. And by the way, this is something also. People say corny, cheesy, hammy. Those three things basically mean the same thing, and they're negative. But corn, cheese, and ham are all delicious. Why are they?
I disagree on ham.
Okay, I mean, listen, we it's not my
two
first
of three.
Choice
yes. At, yeah. Yeah.
You know what? Here's where ham wins. I don't like ham as a cold cut. But I really don't like it.
No.
Prosciutto is different,
no.
But I don't like it. I would never eat a ham sandwich. But never.
A ham sandwich is like, that's something that was out of like pure desperation. Like you got stuck and it was free, and that's how you ended up with a ham sandwich. I don't think anyone's actually bought a ham sandwich before. Like, this is my choice of sandwich. If it is, I would judge.
Can I tell you one
deeper.
Further? Yeah. I literally would skip a meal versus having a ham sandwich.
Oh,
like,
I would
well,
too.
We got ham sandwiches here. Like you've been in.
I don't think they make
things.
Good.
Like, they got sandwiches. What kind of sandwich
you got?
Like,
well,
we got a ham
bread.
Cheese. Like, God, forget it. I don't need it.
Yeah, it's true. You know what I mean, though? I don't think they make them on good bread. I think that a ham sandwich only comes on, like, terrible bread. It's because they know this is awful.
Water finds its level, and so does swine, apparently. But here's
the
thing.
That's it.
What you do is, if people make a ham at a holiday thing, and then in the morning, if there's still some in the fridge, here's what you do. I want you to chip some pieces off of there. Now throw them into a pan. Now you're cooking with gas. And let me tell you something. I'll go so far as to say that if you get some ham going in that pan for breakfast with some eggs, it might trump, maybe just as a once in a while alternative. You can talk yourself into, this might be better than bacon or sausage. I'm not saying you would stick with that 6 months in, but you could make a pretty good run living on breakfast ham.
Okay. This is a strong ham opinion. I love it. I'm glad that we got a food take in from you before this thing wrapped up. Okay. I know you got to run. So last topic, last thing is just simply this. So you said it, you know, your feelings as a sports fan aren't always tied to just like the wins and losses, but here's, how do you feel about Dubas now versus when Dubas first arrived? Like, where is your general Dubas sentiment today?
Dubious sent. I mean,
love,
too
hate,
easy to
patient,
dubious.
Failure, hate him.
Yeah,
divisive.
I don't want to be. I don't want to be hammy and say that that I'm dubious about his future. But I do think. You know, it's funny. I was immediately. You know how I know. I feel like I kind of have faith in what he's going to do. But when I heard the bunting deal, my initial reaction was like, he's just getting his old guys back? Like, what? Yeah. That's what he's come up with here to try and fix this mess.
A lot of cups though, so it's going to work for you. You know, like he's kind of came from Toronto where it was so many playoff rounds that we had won under Dubas's tenure that you know you can have a little faith in it, right? It's tried,
great
tested,
news,
and true.
Hey, Lemieux, Yager, Ronnie Francis, Sidney Crosby, and Geno Malkin fans, guess what? Yeah. We're rebuilding the Leafs model here.
Yep, that's what you got. Hey, what did you say at the beginning of this interview? Consistency isn't always the best thing. It's like, yeah, this is sort of Dumas. He seems like in Knocked Up, the dice guy. It's like, oh, he's doing the dice move again? Okay, good. Yeah, he's tying up all his cap with the same couple of stars and then saying he can get good depth guys, but then none of them really materialize and he loses every trade. Okay. Yeah. That's the Dubas scouting report from our eyes.
Didn't we start out also with me telling you I'm down in the dumps and all you've done is to bring me further down.
Yeah. Well,
now I have mud just like the Steelers do to their foes. Bunkus has dragged me down into a Leafs frame of mind.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'll end on this positive then. And then we'll say goodbye. I had Frank Cervelli on the pod a couple weeks ago, and he told me that he thinks that the conversations that Dubas has alluded to with Sidney Crosby have actually already happened and that he is going to be a Penguin for life. That any of the rumors and discussions surrounding, oh, maybe he'll want to go win somewhere else, that ain't happening. Sid's going to be yours, and you'll watch him his whole career, and you're never going to have that awkward, like, Bobby Orr in a Chicago Blackhawks sweater moment. So that's something.
Listen, I feel like in a growing minority of mm-hmm. even Pittsburgh fans where it used to matter more, I guess, or maybe I'm just getting old or whatever and embittered, but that's part of what I'm talking about with, like, I want Malkin back and Letang back. I know they're not going to win cups doing it that way, but it's right.
No, but it feels
right. Means something. You know, Gretzky wore that stupid red accented blue sweater, and there's just no taking that back. There's no erasing that happened. And Lemieux wore one uniform and only one uniform. And Mean Joe Green wore only one uniform. And Terry Bradshaw. And so it should be for Sidney Crosby, number 87. The Pittsburgh Penguins, two of the five greatest players in the history of people. What a team. That's what keeps me warm. Okay. And by the way, I can see my reflection in the cup too. So, you know, what do I have to complain about? Except Pitt not being in the tournament and the Steelers screwing up their QB room and the Pirates are about to start playing 162 games. Ugh.
Yeah. And Dubas eventually tearing your fan base apart, which he will do.
I gotta go.
Yeah. Dave Damashek, -3 podcast, subscribe, review. Thanks so much for making time, buddy. Always a pleasure.
Sure thing. You're the best, man.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Today is just sort of the kickoff of what I think is the best time of the year for sports. We're here. This is kind of like this is my opening day. It's March Madness Day. First Thursday, full slate of games. There's baseball on TV this morning. It was like 100 to 200 between the Dodgers and the Padres. I watched a little bit of it when I first woke up, and Yamamoto got one inning. Mookie Betts booting balls at shortstop. Shohei's already embroiled in a scandal. I don't know, Dodgers fans. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. So, yeah, it's baseball season. Blue Jays are next week. There's going to be a ton of Blue Jays content. I love this time so much. It's the best. March Madness, getting baseball on the horizon. Playoffs are right around the corner for NBA and the NHL. Stanley Cup playoffs first round, nothing beats it. It's just, this is so good. I don't know how anybody even debate. Like, I get it, fall, I get it. Football comes back, baseball playoffs, great. But this, This is the time. This is the time, baby. Anyway, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Posted my picks. I'm 3 for 3 so far in tournament picks. Just got to say, 3 for 3 in tournament picks so far. Going to be posting them all throughout the tournament. So, and again, I'm stealing these from other people. Like, don't worry. These aren't, I think that some people actually, you're probably better off just picking them out of a hat and going, all right. But I'm consulting. I'm trying to see who likes what, piece it together, make the connections. Who likes the same things that I think are smart that actually track the stuff. So I'll be posting a bunch of those things. And then, yeah, reach out anytime, hit me up there. And then, yeah, plenty of Blue Jays stuff next week. Cause yeah, we're getting into the opening week. It's go time now. Now it's time to build a little bit of the hype. It's time to put away a bit of the pessimism of this offseason and try to just embrace what is there. I think the slogan for the Blue Jays is to the core this year. So that'll be me. To the core. It will be to the core. To the core. I'm going to yell that every single time they hit a home run. Every single time. All 8 times. I'm going to yell that. Anyways, let's do a quick break. Let's come back. I got Mike Bibby, but also, holy crap, the Raptors are in some kind of way. So I'm guessing you didn't watch a lot of the Raptors game last night. Because, frankly, how could you right now? Now, Manuel quickly didn't play. Raptors were down to calling them a skeleton crew is generous. It's starting to feel very reminiscent of the Tampa season where the Raptors just accepted their fate and started to get uber cautious with injuries and everything stacked against them. And it became a real accepted tank. They now, in their last 10 games, according to Sportsnet stats, the good people at Sportsnet stats tweeted this. The last 10 games, the Raptors have been outscored by 142 points. It's the worst 10-game stretch they've had from a point differential standpoint since 1998. Oh, this is worse than the Tampa season. That they're doing stuff that the Tampa tank couldn't even do right now. I've got a couple thoughts on this. One is, I actually bought tickets to the Oklahoma City game like a month ago. I thought I was getting a pretty decent price. I was taking Ennis for his 40th birthday. I said, you know what? Let me take Ben's turning 40. Let me grab him some nice Raptors tickets. The two of us will have a night in the city and make sure I'll jump out and get these before people realize, oh, Shea is in town. And now I'm terrified to look at what the secondary ticket market is for Raptors game. Luckily, it's a Raptors game on a Friday night. So usually that is immovable. Usually that is just consistently stays high, stays party night. But now I'm living in fear of the Raptors are so bad that Shea comes to town and the Thunder go, well, we're not even going to play him. We might as well do rest night. I'm guessing they won't do that because he's the Canadian guy. He probably wants to play in Toronto, but I cannot look at the secondary ticket market. And the fact that I'm going to be leaving March Madness night games to go watch the Raptors is kind of crushing. It's almost like a joke gift now for him. I'm like, hey, surprise, going to leave the bar and the multiple screens that we're going to be watching to go to the Raptors game and watch them get pumped by 30 points. It's so bad that it feels like, you know, a night like last night should be refund night. What are you watching it for? And this is the crushing part about it is it's two things. And I tried to kind of outline them earlier, but now you just don't feel as though you've got a lot of research or understanding of some of these guys. You're going to go and pay quickly this really big contract. He's going to get a lot of money. And you kind of know what you have. You've got a guard who's undersized, who can hit some pull-ups. And this franchise has done well with undersized guards, so shouldn't be completely freaked out by that. Good shooter, I think a good player, but you would have liked a little bit more information because I think that the floor for his contract is pretty obvious. Like that was sort of the Jakob Poeltl thing when they made that trade. You went, okay, you know, it's going to be important. You're going to have this guy, I guess going to give him $20 million. Like, I think in the NBA, it's really hard whenever now you're going to overpay guys at all. And so for the Raptors, it's going to be a difficult position, I think, that they're going to be in with quickly because they're going to have to pay him like he is a fully known commodity when I just don't think that's really what he is yet. We don't know how he really fits around some of this core. You're not getting any meaningful or good reps from anybody right now. Like the R&D for the Toronto Raptors is incomplete. I should have done R&D as INC. That's, I would like a do-over, and that's what I would like to do. R&D is INC. You haven't figured anything out. You really don't know. Like, you know your coach has got guys to buy in on passing the ball and moving the ball this year. That's one thing. You got Scotty Barnes, who was stuffing stat sheets and who made an all-star game, but there were still questions this year about the consistency. And just as he was turning a corner and just after the all-star break where we thought, okay, more attention to detail, take leadership of this team, he gets hurt. Jacoperto gets hurt. It's just a tough, they're in a really, really, really tough position right now. And now your prize, by the way, is like, I hate reminding people of this because it almost feels like you're taking unnecessary air out of the balloon. But, you know, last night yesterday's show, I do an NCAA preview and I go, okay, here are the Raptors players to watch. And I tell you guys, okay, go watch the Buffalo's game last night. And for those of you that did, for those of you that decided, you know what, I'm going to stay up and I'm going to watch this rock fight of a college basketball game, this slog of a college basketball game that's on the 2-10 seed battle, right? These two teams, not exactly the most prestigious college basketball programs in the Colorado Buffaloes and Boise State. If you happen to tune in for that, which I did after Leafs talk, you know, I get back to the monitor. I had it on the second screen, kind of taking little peeks at it. But if you happen to look, Cody Williams, who could end up being the Raptors' prize in the tournament this year, the guy who is projected by most people to be the first North American player taken off the board, the first player from the NCAA tournament to be taken off the board, Cody Williams, he last night, in a game of 2-10 seeds, in a game where nobody could score, like nobody, rock fight. This kid, Da Silva, was basically carrying Colorado. He had 20 points. This guy, Simpson, the two of them basically trading off. Everybody else, rock fight. Two guys in a rock fight. Cody Williams, the projected first overall American pick in this year's draft, finished with 11 minutes. No points, 0-for-4, one rebound, and a turnover. Whew. This wasn't the national championship game. This wasn't, oh, okay, Cody Williams is he's a freshman. He's playing against Duke in the national championship. Like, no, he's playing Boise State in a 10-seed first four matchup, and his coach looked at him and said, buddy, we can't give you more than 11 minutes here. That 11 minutes is too much for you. Like, ew, that's bleak. That's some pretty bleak stuff. Anyways, going on Friday, I'm going to try to still strap in to catch a few moments of these games and try to find some glimmers of hope or reasons to watch or reasons to believe or reasons to try to project forward in terms of what the Raptors are going to have here. But it really does feel like they're going to end up with a lottery pick in this year's draft, kick over next year's pick in a better draft, draft someone the ilk of 11 minutes, one rebound in a must-win game in a huge spot in college, and run down the clock with a bunch of guys who are not going to be available to them. Anyways, sorry for that. I did get a chance yesterday to speak with Mike Bibby, who was honestly I was a point guard. I had a dad who was a basketball coach, and I had an uncle who went to Arizona, and I tuned in for college basketball at a very, very young age. I was like 9 years old when Arizona went and won a national championship, and I remember watching it with, you know, great intrigue, going, this is great. And that was my uncle's university. That's where he went. And watching Mike Bibby as a freshman, and as I was kind of like transitioning into becoming, someone who was taking basketball pretty seriously as like a young age. Like, it was very much the thing that I was the most into. I was pretty obsessed actually for most of my childhood and young adult life. Like, it's why I ended up quitting playing every other sport, was just to focus on basketball, basketball, basketball. That's all I wanted to do, was play basketball. Unfortunately, you know, I was a 5'10" non-athletic guy, and so it started to have its ceiling. But yeah, I really, you know, Mike Bibby was a guy that I really tried to emulate myself after. And then he ends up going to Canada, and, you know, I was a guy in the West Coast. So it was really, really, really fun to talk with Bibby. Here's that interview now. Got Mike Bibby on the line. Very excited to speak to him. I will say this to you, Mike. So doing this business for a long time and having, done sports radio, sports podcasting, all of it for just a little bit over a decade, people always ask me, like, hey, who are the people that you get most nervous for? You get most nervous for, and you're like, yeah, you know, the biggest names, some of them don't even really faze you. It's people that you watched when you were just like a young kid in seminal moments. And I had an uncle who went to Arizona University. And when I was 10 years old, he showed me March Madness for the first time. And I watched you guys rip through 3-1 seeds and end up winning a championship. And it was like one of the most fun things. It's honestly one of the things that probably like most propelled me into sports. And I got to say, like, my first childhood basketball hero was probably Miles Simon. I'll never forget the feeling I had as a kid being like, how is he a second round pick? That doesn't make any sense. Mike Bibby was a high pick. And kind of going from there. But it's a real pleasure to have you on, man.
Appreciate you having me on. No worries.
Yeah, no, it's cool to have you. So I do want to ask you, like, this kind of time for you, as we get closer to the tournament, does it, like, it's been a long time, but do you get a little emotional around this time of year? Like, is there stuff that kind of always crystallizes for you that always kind of pops up in your head?
No, not emotional, but I just look back and, you know, be one of the very few people to have a national championship. It feels good. And just, I mean, the camaraderie that our team had and how, you know, a lot of us still talk. So it's going to, I mean, it holds a lot of memories for the teams. It holds a lot of memories for me. And just to go back, it's basketball nonstop. It's just a fun time just to watch basketball and see what guys, you know, are going to earn the spot to get drafted into the NBA.
Yeah, that's such a fun part of it for like the casual fans who don't track it year round, right? Is finally getting to see some of these players and the opportunity that some of the guys have a team. I'm kind of curious though what your thoughts are on college basketball now, right? Like, you were a guy who went back to school after you won a national championship, you know? You were part of a program, mm-hmm. and it did really feel like, you know, you were familiar with the cast and the characters each year, right? Like, who was on what team? Because normally you would watch a team sort of grow together, and now the landscape is changing pretty rapidly. And like, I think that, you know, and you would probably agree, having been a high level college athlete, that everybody sort of wanted fair compensation. Everybody wanted something that, yeah, felt a little bit more equitable. But like, how do you feel about the state of college basketball today?
I mean, it's tough because, you know, I mean, a lot of guys, you know, I like to see these kids learn more. You know, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get into coaching, and I want to coach, you know, be either a college coach or an NBA coach, just where I could give back the knowledge that I have and show these guys how to work and how to push themselves and how to be the greatest player they could be. But the situation in college now, it's tough because, you know, it kind of leaves the high school kids out. The high school kids are looked at last now, unless you're a top, you know, 25, 30 player now. You get passed on because you're looking to see who's going to be in the portal. And now guys have to wait longer to see what school they're going to go to. And it's just stuff like that. But, you know, I just think it's hard, you know, having kids that, you know, bounce from school to school every year and just change schools like it's nothing. That would be tough for me. And I mean, just the way I grew up, I want to stick it out and be tough. Like, I teach my kids, like, don't run from competition, you know, you got to do what you got to do to beat that out. And it builds character. I think it just makes you stronger, a stronger person.
Well, that's the part, again, as an outsider, that feels like it's resonating the most from guys like yourself, right? Like, I'm sure, like, you know, you can't even put into words what Lute Olson meant to you, especially at that time of your life, right? And you think about how young some of these guys are and how, you know, young you were when you were doing this. Man, hell, you're probably looking back on it sometimes now thinking like, man, that was like a lifetime ago. I was a child, essentially. But yeah, the kind of the development, not as just basketball players, but as people, and that the professionalization that early is having a bit of a drawback in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, Coach Olson was the best. You know, he cared about you. It wasn't just all basketball stuff. He cared about you as a person, you know, whether however long you stayed there. You know, we had a good talk when I was leaving, and he knew it was the best option for me. And, you know, a lot of these guys figure they're going to get a kid for 1 year, 2 years, depending on how it goes. And if they don't like it, they could go somewhere else. And if they don't like that, they could go somewhere else. So, I mean, it's just tough to see, and just I wish it was different in that aspect. But I love that the kids are getting compensated for what they're doing and being on the court after making all these colleges make so much money off of them. It's just good to see because, you know, when we were playing, we weren't even allowed to get a free slice of pizza.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, I mean, it was tough to live back then. And, I don't know if I'll give these kids millions and millions, but I mean, I think they need somewhat to be compensated somehow, some way.
Yeah. That's what's like the hard line to draw here, right? Is that it's like, okay, you want them to be compensated, but you also understand the pitfalls of players just jumping university, wherever like the best business opportunity is for them, right? Like I was watching an interview where I was watching a clip of Nick Saban the other day talking about how, yeah, he sat down at dinner with his wife one night and she said, why are we even doing this? Like, why are we trying to sell people on the program when really all they want to know is how much money they're going to get? And that it altered his viewpoint as a coach and was part of the reason that, you know, he was ultimately pushed out of it. And I just don't know what, I guess I don't know where we go from here. Like, I'm not sure where they even begin when it comes to trying to create some type of middle ground with the payment and the business side of this, but also the development and the feel like this is still, you know, college athletics and not professional athletics.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, some of these kids are getting paid more than the coaches. And, you know, I mean, it's like the era of, you know, I mean, it's just reality to where, you know, kids, a lot of people won't let a person that they're making more money than tell them what to do. You know, I mean, that's just life and that's just the way it goes. And, but I mean, like I said, I mean, it's good that they're getting this money. I mean, you never might be able to make this money again. I mean, something might happen. You might, God forbid something happens when you, where you can't go to that next level and that's the money you'll be making. But I mean, I'm all for the kids making money. And I mean, just the state of the portal stuff. Now the high school kids got to wait to see if they're going to get recruited. And it just makes it all the way around. It makes it all the way around tough.
You know what, though? That is why I think that it is important for guys like you to be coaching and guys like you to be giving back and kind of sharing that, especially since, like, you know, you do talk about the money and it's like, no, you were an accomplished NBA player with a long time career, right? You were able to secure a bag. And so I do think that that's something that even now a kid who's trying to be a young professional is going to have an easier time to relate to. And I think like part of that is a little unfortunate, the idea that, you know, the only way to relate to a lot of kids now is going to be if you are, you know, uber successful financially in a different field. Like you said, hard to listen to someone who makes less. But yeah, I'm glad that someone like you does want to give back. I like that someone like you, yeah, you know, has had a son go through Div 1 and has seen all these checkpoints. And I do think that it's probably going to be integral moving forward if these games are going to stay as best as they can, that guys like you were involved. So I want to go back a little bit to when you first get drafted too, because when you agreed with Lute and you said, you know, you had that conversation, did you think there was a good shot that you were going to go to Canada? Like, would you have done it different if you knew you were going to get drafted by the Grizzlies?
No, I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, it was supposed to be the Clippers. I mean, it was between me and Michael Kennedy for a long time. And I didn't find out, you know, I only worked out for one team. I worked out for the Clippers. I didn't work out for anybody else. And my agent was super agent David Falk. And, you know, the first thing, we didn't find out that they were taking all of Kennedy till we got to the draft. You know, I was 19 years old, just turned 20. With two kids. I mean, I had one kid, one on the way. And, I mean, it was just the thing of I didn't want to have to uproot my family to a different country. And, you know, I was blessed and grateful that I got drafted. But my thing was, you know, it was going to be tough. We're, you know, me and my fiance, we were, you know, 19, 20 years old, you know, a newborn, I mean, probably like a 2-year-old kid, 1-year-old kid, 2-year-old kid with one on the way. It was just tough. It was going to be hard for me, I think, to try to get everything going at that age. I didn't think I was ready to go out the country at that young of age.
Yeah, who is? Like, that? This is actually one of the, I think, you know, for Canadian sports fans, especially just more so with MLB and NBA, there's like a sensitivity about being like the other. But part of it comes from the fact that for us, thinking about like going to the States, most people don't think of that as much of a culture shock because we get so much like American TV and so much of our like pop culture is influenced by like the United States that we don't view the separation, especially then, right? Like we're talking about, like you said, you're 20 years old at this time going to the Grizzlies. It's a completely different era. But the other part of it too is I wonder at that time, when you get drafted by the Grizzlies, what's the support system look like at the time in terms of being like, hey, this is a 20-year-old kid who is got, you know, like you just mentioned, a brand new young family in terms of trying to help you set up and get established so that you're not just completely lost in the wilderness. Was there anything?
I had family with me, two brothers, you know, I had a cousin that had moved with me as well. But I mean, it was nothing against the city of Vancouver.
Of course.
Canadians. It was nothing against the Vancouver Grizzlies. It was just, that was the fact of me being young and I wasn't ready to go. So when I remember when I found out that the Clippers were going to take all of the candy, you know, I met with Stu Jackson and Brian Hill, and I told him, I said, it has nothing to do about the city. It has nothing to do about you guys. I don't want to go to another country. I don't want to play here. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know what, we're going to take you anyway. And, you know, I mean, I was going to do what Francis did and, you know, like, hey, I'm not coming here. Don't pick me. I'm not, you know what I mean? So I wasn't going to do that. But I mean, still, I figured they'd have some play. But I mean, the draft is funny. Like, you got to go with what you need. And, you know, Denver had the third pick and, you know, they had guards already. I mean, you just go all the way down the line. Some of those teams were already set. So that's just the way the draft falls. But I just wasn't ready to go to another country.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing like, you know, your memories at the time then though, if you had a newborn on the way and a, you know, 2-year-old kid and a brand new wife and you're moving to a country and you're trying to get established in the NBA, that you probably didn't get out much and you probably didn't, I'm guessing that you didn't explore Vancouver too much, right? Like you must have been in the gym and you must have been at home.
I didn't. It was tough because, I mean, it wasn't that the team wasn't good. It was just that everybody was young. The superstars on our team were young. And, you know, Sharif Abdur-Rahim, superstar for the team. He's 21.
Yeah.
Country Reeves, superstar for the team. He's 23. So it isn't like you had an older guy that's going to bring you along. And Lee Mayberry broke his hand, so I was thrown into the fire right away. So you got three guys under 23 starting for a team that really hasn't had any success. And, I mean, it was a different game back then, too. Mm-hmm. But it was just hard. It's going to be hard with young guys at your core like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course it's going to be. Actually, you know what, though? That's kind of a good parallel for where the Raptors are at right now. Like, I'm sure you don't get too much of a chance to watch them out of this game. Like, why are you watching a team that's in the lottery at this point? But they are a super young team. Like, they do have guys who are those ages that you're referencing, kind of trying to find their way now as the leaders of a team. And I'm wondering, like, you now reflecting and looking back on the challenges of that of Vancouver. And I know, again, it's a different time. It's a different era. The league is a lot younger, too, now. But, you know, what you think the most difficult part is outside of just the losing, right? Like, because, again, you came from a winning program. You won a national championship. And now you're going to a team with a bunch of young guys that's a bit rudderless. You're not winning games. But, you know, if you were to sit down with, say, this Raptors team and talk to, like, the Scottie Barneses and the Quickleys of the world, like, this young core that they're trying to build, what would be kind of, like, the advice that you would try to guard them against being on a team that looks like they're going to be in the lottery for some time?
Just try to stay the course. You know, I mean, you never know how quick it's going to be. And, mm-hmm. I mean, we were in a lot of games in Vancouver. It was just that we couldn't finish them off. And that came with age. And, I mean, I don't know. I mean, because you never know. Like, maybe there's some pieces in the movie. You might need to get an older veteran in there. You know, I mean, the year I left, they moved to Memphis after that year. So it was like you can't really say what would have happened when they cleaned house. You know what I mean? You never know because it was two totally different situations after that. But, I mean, Toronto has been a successful team a lot of these years. And in the time that the Grizzlies were, they weren't. You know what I mean? So it's really hard to It's really hard to put kind of in the same category. But I don't know what I'd tell him. I mean, just kind of try to stay the course, keep working, and just, I mean, if you could get better guys there, older guys, veteran presence helps a lot. You know, if you don't have that, it's going to be kind of the blind leading the blind. And you just kind of get a veteran presence, the guys that have won before, just kind of bring winning mentality back to them and just show what it takes to do winning mentality. Kind of like when I got traded to the Atlanta Hawks, I had to take a different role when I went to the Atlanta Hawks. And it was kind of like the Vlade Divac role of Sacramento, you know, the older guy. You know, Joe Johnson was the only good player on the team that had been to the playoffs. And just little stuff like that. I came in and would organize dinners with the guys, would organize, hey, we're all going to go to the mall, walk around a little bit, hang out. And it made it better. The camaraderie got better, and we were friends off the court, not just on the court, and it made us play better.
Who was that first vet for you? Like, who was the, if you had to say, like, I know you just said Vlade Divac's role. So was he the guy, like, when you arrived in Sacramento, was he the one that kind of stirred the drink or had the most impact on the way that you would later become a vet to those guys in Atlanta?
Yeah, he was the reason why. You know, I mean, I seen, when I got there, I realized how basketball was supposed to be played. You know, it was tough in Vancouver because both of our superstars were both inside players. So back then the game was played inside out. So, you know, we'd go to country, then we'll go to Sharif. And then if it came out of there, then we're scrambling to get a jump shot or something like that. So it was tough for me to play that way when I was used to playing a different way. But Vlade Divac was that guy. He, you know, he organized on the plane. We were playing cards. He was always the same person, you know, whether he played great or played bad. He was always the same Vlade. And that wore off on me. And just like, you know what? Make it fun for these guys and just be there for them and just try to make a fun situation with everybody. You're with each other for eight, nine months. We got to have some kind of camaraderie, be together, have fun, and you know, like everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those Sacramento teams are still, like, it was probably easier, too, to have fun when you went from, I was looking at it, you won 23 games your last year with Vancouver, you won 61 the next season in Sacramento.
I won more games in Sacramento my first year than I won in three in Vancouver.
Yeah, all of a sudden you're playing with Weber and Vlade, and it's just like, oh, this is nice. This is a much more fun.
Yeah, it was a different game. Like I said, you're playing inside out. Yeah. So I like in Vancouver, I come and throw the ball in the post every play. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then was like, in my first practice in Sacramento, I throw it to Webb or Vlade, and I just cut through just to go to the other side because I'm used to just run to the other side, and the ball almost hits me in the head. And, you know, Coach Kirill, rest in peace, he would say, Mike, these guys pass the ball. Be ready when you cut through. So then I realized, okay, we're playing basketball now, and that was the best feeling in the world.
Man, you know what's crazy, though, just about, like, the evolution of the game? I saw a stat not too long ago. It was, like, in January that, you know, your Kings team led the NBA with something that was, like, 24 assists per game. And that's one of the legacies of, you know, your era with the Sacramento Kings. Like, assists per game.
What?
Like, assists per game. Yeah, like, team assists per game. And now it's, like, that would be dead last in the NBA. It's, like, you guys led the league at the time in most assists per game, and now it's like, yeah, you guys, no chance. Like, and all I remember then is, like, the ball movement of your teams and thinking, man, this is so awesome watching these Kings teams because everybody could pass the ball, you know? Like, there were so many smart players on and off the ball, and it just clicked. And it's the reason, I think, or a huge reason why you guys were so successful, right? Like, it was that, like you said, that high IQ. You must have felt some pressure, though, when you went there, right? Like, because you were traded for a fan favorite. Like, White Chocolate at the time is one of the, you know, biggest names in all of basketball. Like, yeah, you want to talk about, like, seminal moments for kids my age. It's like watching the elbow pass at an all-star game and going, all right, you're going to try this a billion times over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you go there. And again, you guys have success right away, and then you just win, right? You end up going to a conference finals where it's rigged against you. But, You know, did you feel that pressure when you were arriving there? Like, did you know what a kind of cultural phenomenon he was at the time? And, like, did you feel that added pressure to do that? Yeah.
I did. And it was what made it easy for me is the fans and the team. They made me feel like I had been there for 10 years. And that's, I mean, I felt the pressure going in, like, dang, what's to do? My agent, Dave Falk, he was like, go in there. Don't try to do nothing spectacular. Just go in and fit in. The team's already established. Fit in. And I went there and fit in. You know, I mean, I wasn't really doing, I averaged 13 points in the during the regular season. And, you know, with the best record in the NBA, I felt good about that. You know what I mean? Being the guard, being the point guard of the team that's the best record in the league, it kind of reflects on you and shows you that you're doing something good. But I did have those worries going there for Jason Williams, and like you said, a fan favorite, great guy, I love the guy. But going in there, that was my biggest fear. Like, damn, how are the fans going to take me, or how's the team going to take me? And going in, that's what made it so easy for me, because the fans accepted me right out the gate. The team accepted me right out the gate. And it made it so much easier for me to be comfortable and play basketball and not have to worry about impressing them, because they accepted me with open arms, both of those people, both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is big. You know, it's funny, like, that this is the way I could probably speak to the how much respect I have for Sacramento Kings fans is when I can't remember what year it was. And what was the year where the team was rumored to move to Seattle? That's like 2011, 2012. Somewhere in there?
I was gone by then. I don't know.
Yeah. But I mean, like, there was this year where, I was saying, I grew up a Seattle Supersonics fan.
The year they probably were getting the arena, trying to change the arena.
Yeah, that's it. So that I grew up a Sonics fan. Like, I'm sitting in my office right now, and I've got Peyton and Kemp posters, like, in my office hanging over where my desk is. And there was this thought of Sacramento was going to move to Seattle. And I would tell people, they would be like, are you excited? And I was like, no, I do not want Sacramento to lose the basketball team, because those were some of the realest fans that you ever saw growing up. Like that horrible arena, but with those loud ass fans, it was like, I would never want those people that cared that much during that era to lose a basketball team and feel the way that I felt when the Sonics moved to OKC. Like, that's how great the Sacramento fans were. So I'm not really surprised to kind of hear that story, especially given the success you guys had.
And it's not the fans' fault. You know what I mean? It's they weren't winning at a time. You know, they broke a 16-year playoff streak last year. And you can't blame the fans. Like, even in Vancouver, we weren't winning. You can't blame the fans for not coming to the game. You know, I remember one of the main reasons I want to go to Sacramento, I mean, of course, of how they played, but being in Vancouver, going to all these on the road games, and you know, you have 5,000 people in the stands, 6,000-7,000 people in the stands, and go to Sacramento and they got 15,000-16,000 people in the stands. That appealed to me. I want to play here. It's the last game of the season. I remember like it was yesterday. It was the last game of the season. There, but we're ready to go home. We count our days from February, how many days till we go home? And it's like, oh my gosh, we're playing in front of 15,000-16,000 people right now. It's amazing. This is where I want to go.
Yeah,
you know, and so that was a big one of the big reasons why I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty special as a player, and who wouldn't want that? Okay, so you've been really generous with the time. I'll let you go after this one. I do have to ask you, you know, anybody that played with LeBron, it's crazy because you guys were in 2011 together, right? You were on the team that lost to the Mavs.
I got traded after All-Star break, so I don't know how many games I played.
Yeah,
but I got traded to the Wizards, played two games there, and then
those
got bought out,
and then went to the Heat. Yeah, so you go like, can you believe that? So it's what? That's 13 years ago. That LeBron is still playing this way at this level.
At a high level. I mean, it's just amazing just to see the things that he still does. I mean, he was a physical specimen even back then. You know what I mean?
That was not yeah.
just how big he was, his size. I think he probably weighed like 270. I remember hearing somebody weigh like 270 back then. Like to be that heavy and to be able to run that fast and jump that high is crazy. But I mean, he's still doing it at a high level. I mean, look at all the stats that guys his age and how many years he played in. You know, I think the highest might have been Vince Carter, maybe at like 10, 11 points. You know what I mean? He's still averaging 25, 26, 27 points a game. It's miraculous. And to crack the 40,000 point code, I'm looking at my numbers. Like, I did pretty good. You know what I mean? I got 14,500 points. I'm looking at, and then you look at that and see 40,000. I mean, that will probably never happen again. I mean, the points, the scoring has obviously went up. You never know. Some of these guys might have a chance that came in averaging 20 something their first year. You know, like there's a few guys that are averaging that might have a chance at it. But I mean, just to see him doing that at a high level, you know, it breaks the physics of, the age barrier, you know, thinking like age always catches everybody. So, I mean, it looks like it hasn't caught up with him yet. I mean, it's good to see him keep going, but you take for granted him being here. You never know how long that he'll be gone.
No, I totally agree with you. And that's the crazy thing about him is like, okay, you know, it's harder for guards to age because, you know, you lose that step and all of a sudden it's harder for you to score, harder to defend, all these different things. Like you can get away with some things at size, but that's like the height portion of this. Like it makes sense to me that a guy like Chris Paul could continue to play the game, or like, you know, Andre Livingston was one of the guys where it was like, oh, okay, this makes sense that he's going to be able to play into old age. But I'll never forget like the first time I stood next to LeBron in a locker room during his Heat years, because that's the first time I got to cover the game. That was the same thought I had though, was looking at him and being like, it's not that you're tall, it's like you're just massive and that you move this way, that you've got the gait of a guy who's like 5'11", you know, like you move like you're a marathon runner and you're this size. It's intimidating. Like, it's like, holy crap. Yeah, it feels like you're looking at an alien.
He's definitely different. He's definitely different, but I mean, it's just good to see him still doing it. You know, a lot of these kids, you know, different eras. He got to play with a lot of different eras, and then you just got to be grateful that you got to see it in person.
100%. Hey, Mike, again, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for it.
No problem.
I hope you try to enjoy the Raptors game. And again, thanks for helping inspire me to a career with basketball. I'll never forget reading your profile in Slam Magazine and being like, okay, you know, I was also a coach's son, and I remember a lot of it really stuck with me and resonated with me, and I always really appreciated your career. Thanks for making this, man.
All right. Thank you very much. No problem. Thanks for having me.
There it was, Mike Bibby. Cool stuff. Yeah, so little moments like that where you get really appreciative of your job, right? And hey, this is cool. I'll say it once, I'll say it again, but those are always the athletes. And I know I talk about it at the top, and those are always the athletes that get you. I remember doing the All-Star game in, God, what was it, 2016 when Toronto had the NBA All-Star game? Because, God, it feels like it's been a million years now. 2016, I think that was the year. And, you know, you're walking around. I got to be courtside and walk around. And it was really cool because there was, at the time, you know, cool celebrities like Von Miller and Odell Beckham were there. And you're like, holy crap. And John Stewart was there. That one I was freaking out about. Thank God I didn't have any interaction with John Stewart, because it would have been horrible for me to even try to say two words to John Stewart. Steve Nash was there. I remember Jason Sudeikis and seeing Kobe. And it was neat. It was a very, very cool experience. But still the most like starstruck that I was at All-Star Weekend was, there's like a Legends Row bench that you had to go over to, where they basically sat a bunch of players from the 90s. And I'm just standing there, and it's like Detlef Schrempf and Muggsy Bogues and Robert Horry. And you're just standing there, Mitch Richmond. And I'm just staring at these guys going, unbelievable. This is so cool. So yeah, I think that vintage of player, right? Late 90s, early 2000s, when, you know, you're a little kid and you're watching sports, or for me, when I was a little kid watching sports, that's when guys really sink in as kind of heroes. And that's what, you know, I started this week having a conversation with Ennis about how, you know, you pivot as a sports fan now, right? From, you idolize these guys to, they are almost viewed weirdly as your age, or not your peers, but people that are your age, to all of a sudden kind of starting to where you're like moving out of it. And you're like, what is this? What is this for me now? How do I evaluate these things? Well, we're going to start calling them all these kids. That transition, it's going to be a weird one. It's going to be a difficult one. Anyways, March Madness today, tradition that I love so much. I love it. That's why I'm always nervous that they're going to tinker with it and they're going to screw with it. And even last night when I was watching the Buffalo's game in the 4-in, I'm like, why do we need this? I guess fine, whatever. It's a revenue maker. But as all these things make more and more money and we get more and more greedy, I get a little nervous that this is the way that it's going to go and that they're going to tinker with this kind of stuff. But yeah, I got a bunch of picks. I'm ready to go. I got all my bets mostly in. I got my initial smartest bets in. I'm going to tweet a bunch of them and post a bunch of them on my Instagram later today, probably in about an hour. But yes, I cannot wait to just rot watching college basketball and then hang out with some buddies, including Ennis, tomorrow before I go to that Raptors game and watch a bunch of games in the bar, sit there for a few hours and scream at televisions as I'm hoping for college kids to hit over bets. So yeah, thanks to Mike Bibby for making time. Thanks for Dave Damashek. Oh, one last kind of programming note while I'm here before I take my final break. I'm taking tomorrow off because it's March Madness time. And this is also a tradition like any other for me, which is I got to take the Friday off. Now that I'm in the mornings, I can easily take the Thursday. I don't need to take the Thursday off work, but then I want to focus on the games and then I want to rot and watch the games on Friday as well. So I'm not here tomorrow. So no podcast, but I'll be back on Monday. And that week will be just completely, completely, completely chock full of baseball. Because yeah, we're fully into Blue Jays mode now. We're here. The regular season is upon us, and we'll see how many pitchers that the Blue Jays are actually bringing up north. Who's actually going to come here? But with that, I'm going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to close with some thoughts on Santiago Espinal and yeah, the Shohei stuff. Quick break, and we'll be right back.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Happy March Madness Day to everybody who celebrates. My brother has no regard for what I do for a living. Like, he just fires me text messages nonstop during my show sometimes. And like, yes, I guarantee you hasn't watched one college football game. And yeah, he's trying desperately to get in a million picks before he has to go to work today. So tough one. So Santiago Espinal, by the way, yesterday got traded, which felt sort of, it was inevitable. Okay. Like he was getting dealt. This was something that happened at the outset of the off season. There was buzz that he was going to end up getting moved. I'm curious why they held on to him for so long only to move him for, let's be honest, there's a picture that they got for Espinal. I doubt he's ever pitches in the major leagues. Maybe. I think overall, Espinal, the experience here was fun. I enjoyed Espinal. Weird. I think he goes with Steve Delabar as most random Blue Jays players that made All-Star teams. Like, oh, okay, 10 years from now, I think we'll look at him the way that we did look with Delabar. But, man, he had some fun moments. He's a good player. Felt like he was clutch for a little while. Like, obviously not last year, because last year nobody was clutch. Jays couldn't buy a hit in a big spot. But Espinal really did have a moment where, man, there was a case for him based on, don't you feel more confident when he steps to the dish? Don't you feel like he's going to give you an AB? He's going to put the ball in play, and he's going to make something happen. And the glove was always good, but it never materialized into good enough where you felt like, oh, okay, well, now he's going to be the guy at second base for a while, or he can even fill in admirably at short. It always felt like, again, to go back to what we sort of discussed earlier about tweeners with the 3C with the David Camps of the world, he felt like kind of that to me as a infielder, a bit of a tweener in terms of not quite good enough at either spot where he could really lock down a position, and clearly not a good enough bat. But they hold on to him during the entire offseason, despite people prognosticating that he was going to get dealt for cash at the beginning of the offseason. So they keep him here. But it just became more and more apparent that the infield was uber crowded. They like Ernie Clement. And they move off of Espinal for nothing. But yeah, a guy who I think was a little bit of a fan favorite, had a moment, but got swallowed up and lost a little bit of that because of the disappointment of last season and what a difficult watch last season was. So a little bit, I think, disappointing the way it ends up. A fun one to me is, if you could do it over again, you absolutely don't trade for Espinal, though. Because, yeah, he was a fan favorite. He made an All-Star game, and he gave you a lot of good ABs and a lot of good innings, and he played a lot of games for you. And so overall, trading him was worth it, or trading for him was worth it. If you just look at it from a purely unemotional standpoint, turning Steve Pearce on a UFA deal for it's no going nowhere season, it made sense. Trade for Espinal 10 out of 10 times, except for Steve Pearce won World Series MVP with the Boston Red Sox and really was a crucial element in helping them win a World Series. And if it was up to me, I 100% delete Espinal's career as a Blue Jay to make sure that it's harder for the Red Sox to win, or at least roll the dice that the Red Sox don't end up winning. And to me, that's just, unfortunately for him, the All-Star game, the good clubhouse guy, the enjoyable player, the clutch moments, I'm always going to remember him for that. I'm always going to remember him as a Toronto Blue Jay. Whenever we see any graphic of him as that, is the guy that they gave Steve Pearce to, who made all those sick plays at first base for the Boston Red Sox on their way to World Series, where he's stretching out. All of a sudden, he was doing the splits every single second, every single throw, bailing out his other infielders, making huge plays. Ugh. Frustrating. Anyway, good luck to Santiago Espinal. Clearly a guy that I think people here will root for and hope continues to have a career. Anyway, there was a baseball game this morning. I turned it on before I started doing my show. I was going to wrap up on this. I'm going to do more of the Shohei joking around stuff when I have Ennison, I think. Maybe just do it with someone else. I didn't want to just kind of go ranting and raving about this. But, man, it's a fascinating story. Like, if you haven't read about it or paid attention to it at all, Shohei, the Cole's notes are such as this. Shohei Ohtani's interpreter basically told the Dodgers yesterday that he had a gambling addiction, and to the tune of gambling over $400 million of Shohei Ohtani's money. There's some discrepancy as to whether Shohei was going to pay off his debts, whether he was in the know about this. There's a lot of joking online about this being actually Shohei who was making the bets. Either way, this is all I'm saying about it. This feels like the very beginning of something bigger. This feels like this is not just going to be buried and go away. And it involves baseball's biggest star, who is now playing on not the most famous team, but the team, the World Series favorite by far, far, far. It does. It has the feeling of they're scratching the surface on this, and we're going to get a lot more, probably someday, a Netflix documentary that we all end up watching together and talking about, holy crap, can you believe that this guy did this? Anyway, subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars. Please do all those things. It really helps the show, and it takes 1 second. And follow on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Oh, I said 450 million? I said 4.5 million. Oh, either way. I meant 4.5, not 450, obviously. Anyway, we'll see you tomorrow.